Welcome to Frankly Speaking. Today we're going to talk about George Mason, that face on the stamp. I'm Helen Ackerman for George Mason University. When you pick up your mail tomorrow, the odds are that most of the envelopes will be carrying a picture of an 18th century gentleman with the name George Mason running up the side of it. So many people are asking, who is this George Mason, and why should he be featured on our 18-cent stamp? If you live in Northern Virginia, chances are you're at least familiar with the name. After all, there is a bridge, a street, a high school, and this university, all named after him. But if you don't know who he was or what he did, you're in good company. A lot of other people don't know either. With me today to tell us about this man is Dr. Josephine Pacheco, Associate Professor of History at George Mason University. Also in the studio with us is Jack Williams, Information Officer for the Stamps Division of the U.S. Postal Service and Coordinator of the Citizen Stamp Advisory Committee, who will explain how a subject gets chosen for a stamp and when and why the Postmaster General issues new stamps. Dr. Pacheco, who was George Mason?
George Mason is best known as the author of the Virginia Declaration of Rights and the author of the first constitution for the state of Virginia. But he was also a part of that great generation of revolutionary heroes who made the revolution, who fought it, who won it, and who wrote the documents that have preserved the benefits of the revolution for us ever since.
Well, that explains why he's important in Virginia history, but why is he important to Americans as a whole?
He's important to Americans as a whole because once he had written a Declaration of Rights in our Constitution in the state of Virginia, then all the other states began to copy what Virginia had done, so that we find that all the other states in our United States put statements of citizens' rights in the documents that they wrote setting up their new governments. Another reason that everybody in the United States ought to remember him is because he refused to support our federal constitution until it would include a statement of citizens' rights. These became the first 10 amendments to the Constitution.
Since he was so important, why doesn't anybody know who he is?
Because he was never elected to public office. We remember our presidents, we remember our generals, but we don't remember the people who work behind the scenes, the people who are, in a sense, even more important than the presidents and the generals, in a sense, the ones who determine what our lives are going to be.
Mr. Williams, why did the post office decide to put George Mason on the 18-cent stamp?
Well, I think that decision was made based on much of what Dr. Pacheco just said. It had been intimated by some that he was the forgotten patriot from the Revolution, and his time had come. And I'd like to explain that, if I may. Every year, the Postal Service gets about 4,000 suggestions for stamp subjects. And our annual stamp programs are limited to usually less than 20 issues. So the competition for becoming the subject of a stamp is very keen from the outset. And once those 20 subjects have been selected, the other 3,900 some odd, although they're worthwhile and meritorious, sometimes have to wait their turn. And George Mason had been waiting his turn. And we have a Citizen Stamp Advisory Committee that serves the Postal Service and the Postmaster General, made up of 15 people from outside the Postal Service who look at all these suggestions every year and have that rather difficult task of identifying those subjects that should be honored.
Do they meet just once a year?
They meet six times a year.
Good gracious.
And at a meeting about 2 years ago, George Mason's name came up for consideration again, and after discussion, he was recommended to be honored.
And who are these people? Are they from across the country, or are they just from the D.C. area?
They're from throughout the country. And it's the committee is composed of artists, historians, stamp collectors, graphic design specialists, among others. To name a few of the members, Mr. James Michener, rather well-known author, Ernest Borgnine, the actor, the curator of sculpture at the National Gallery of Art, Dr. Douglas Lewis, Mr. Howard Payne, who's the art director for National Geographic magazine, is also a member.
What are the different types of stamps? What's the difference between, say, the George Mason stamp and a commemorative, for instance?
Well, the George Mason stamp is a regular issue postage stamp. We call the regular issues the workhorse stamps of the Postal Service because the primary mission, or purpose rather, of a postage stamp is to transport a piece of mail through our mail system. And we require billions of those stamps every year. A commemorative stamp, on the other hand, commemorates important persons or events in our history, our culture, our traditions, sometimes important social causes. And these are on sale for a much shorter period of time, usually about 90 days, and they're usually more colorful.
How many commemoratives would you issue each year?
Less than 20 commemoratives. And the number of regular stamps to be issued depends upon whenever the postage rates change.
Now, there are two regular stamps available at the moment that I know of, one of which features George Mason and one which has an American flag on it.
There are three with American flags on them.
Is this
usual? We produce regular stamps in three formats, sheet stamps, booklet stamps, and coil stamps. And the American flag design that you've seen is actually the same basic design, except that it varies. It's based on three phrases from the song America the Beautiful, Amber Waves of Grain, Purple Mountain Majesties, and From Sea to Shining Sea.
Dr. Pacheco, George Mason fought for the Bill of Rights, as you've explained, yet he kept slaves. How do you explain that?
Nobody can really explain a question that difficult. Indeed, in my opinion, it is the single most puzzling aspect of the whole revolutionary period. How could these men have fought so valiantly for freedom and have written so brilliantly about freedom and yet held human beings in bondage? Their explanation, and we have to accept it because that's what they said, was that slaves were outside society, that slaves were not a part of society. They didn't hold property. They had no responsibilities to society, and therefore they had no rights in society. And so when men like George Mason could write and talk about all men being created equal and hold slaves at the same time, it seems to us pure hypocrisy. But if we think in 18th century terms, this is probably not the case. This does not excuse, in any sense, the holding of slaves. George Mason knew that slavery was wrong. He knew that slavery was casting a great shadow over the life of the American colonies.
He said this in his writings.
Yes. But slavery was an economic institution, and you can't own 65,000 acres of land and work it yourself.
It seems to me, from what I have read about the period, though, that it's not only slaves who were not considered citizens. People who did not own property, white males who did not own property, were not given that status, and women, of course, had very low status. It almost seems to me that the definition of man as used in the Constitution meant simply a white male property owner. Could that have been the case?
That's not precisely true, and it's something that historians fight over a great deal. In the first place, in the 18th century, it was relatively easy to own property. Property was much more available than it is today. And so if you had to own 50 acres of land or one city lot, that meant that most white males could meet the property qualification. But it is certainly true that servants, and there were servants as well as slaves, that servants did not vote. They were not regarded as members of society. As far as women are concerned, there are few instances in colonial history in which women did have the vote. Very few instances. But they were always women who owned property in their own right. But women in general were not regarded as being sufficiently responsible to have the sacred right to vote.
The Bill of Rights has had far-reaching effects. I wonder if you could tell us about some of the international implications.
The one that is most obvious is the impact that it had in France. A great many Frenchmen came over to help us fight our war for independence, and we're going to be celebrating their most dramatic contribution this year down at Yorktown. Because we might very well not have won the Battle of Yorktown, the decisive battle of the Revolution, if we hadn't had a French army and a French navy to help us at Yorktown. And it's going to be kind of exciting to see all these things reenacted come October. But the Frenchmen who came over here to fight with us for our independence were much impressed with George Mason's Declaration of Rights and took copies back to France, and they were published among the French intellectuals in great numbers. So in 1789, when the French had their revolution, they looked to America for their model, and Mason's Declaration of Rights became the basis for the French Declaration of the Rights of Man and the Citizen. And as other European countries inspired by the French revolutionary spirit had revolutions, you find that they were copied also, so that Mason, sitting in Gunston Hall writing his little document, had worldwide influence.
Mr. Williams, what have we got to look forward to in terms of commemorative or other kinds of stamps in the next year or so?
Well, I'll begin by saying that the surrender at Yorktown that Dr. Pacheco just mentioned is going to be commemorated. We're actually issuing a pair of commemorative stamps, one of which commemorates the surrender at Yorktown, and the other commemorates the Battle of the Virginia Capes, which took place a month or so earlier than Yorktown, in which the French fleet kept the British fleet out, thereby preventing the British forces at Yorktown from being reinforced and bringing about the surrender.
What kind of designs are you going to have on those stamps?
I can't tell you the design today, Doctor, because they haven't been publicly announced. We will be unveiling the designs at a ceremony in Virginia Beach on September 5th.
For both the stamps?
For both stamps, yes. Mm-hmm. And the designs will be made public at that time. I think you'll like them, though.
Well, it sounds like Virginia is going to be starring on the stamps for some time to come, if that's the case. Mr. Williams, I have the $64,000 question for you. Is the Postmaster General going to raise the price of postage again soon?
I can't really comment on that. The need for increases in postage rates is based on the total overall revenue needs of the Postal Service. And other than to say that the Postal Service makes recommendations for whatever revenue it thinks it needs to operate, and this in turn has to be acted upon by an independent Postal Rate Commission that's established by law.
So as far as you know, George Mason is going to be around for a while to come anyway.
Until the rates change again, yes.
I see. Thank you very much, both of you, for being with us today. You've been listening to Frankly Speaking, a public affairs program produced by George Mason University. Production coordinator, Pat Ping. For information about our guests or this program, please call area code 703-323-2138. That's 703-323-2138. I'm Helen Ackerman for the State University in Northern Virginia. Thank you for listening.